Thank you very much for having me here in Copenhagen. It's what a delightful, delightful campus you have. It's just absolutely amazing, and it's great to, I was just saying that it's great to see a real European presence for development coming through, I think particularly through this location. I'm based in Microsoft Research in Cambridge in the UK, and we also try and have a bit of a European presence, of course, in through our research work. But there's a kind of presence that can only be brought by real development work, building real products here in Europe. And we all, it's really very exciting to see that happening here. And good luck with all that work that you'll be doing, that you are doing. So I'm very glad to be able to talk about F#. This is part of a small tour we've been doing over the last 3 days. I was in Chalmers University and also at the Scandinavian Developer Conference in Gothenburg on Tuesday. And then we were in Aarhus yesterday and in Copenhagen University today. And it's a real pleasure to be able to just to present on programming languages in Denmark with this amazing tradition that you have of programming languages work from this country. So today I'm going to be talking about what is F# about, why is Microsoft investing in functional programming, what role do we see it playing. Please interrupt me with questions. You can make the questions as blunt and rude as you want, or any technical details that you want is good. I'll be taking you through some F# programming. And towards the end, I'll talk a little bit about parallel and reactive programming with F# and do some examples of that. Some of the demonstrations will be using the internet. I think we're on a wireless connection here. So depending how my laptop competes with your laptops, we'll see who wins, but hopefully they'll be going okay. So I want to just talk about, in very general terms, about why Microsoft is investing in functional programming. These slides are taken from a talk using this title given to the Commercial Users of Functional Programming workshop last year in Victoria, BC. And in that talk, I bring out three themes, and they're to do with simplicity, and it's sort of this, how does functional programming bring simplicity to various programming tasks? It's also to do with the economics of the .NET platform, about how adding a new language to the .NET platform is a relatively low-cost thing. We already have debuggers, we already have profilers, we already have the just-in-time compilers and the garbage collection and the like, and we can really add a different programming model relatively low cost and still reuse all the libraries and the like that we have available on the .NET platform. And the third theme, sometimes I just actually prefer to use the theme of fun, actually, rather than talking about programming productivity. Perhaps when in a more developer-oriented context, I'll talk about the more direct things about making certain classes of programmers more productive. But there's also an element that F# just makes certain kinds of programming just really very enjoyable. We get a lot of feedback that C#, people who are programming C# actually really enjoy learning F#. They feel like they become better C# programmers, better object-oriented programmers, through also learning to think functionally about parts of their code. And we get a lot of feedback that F# is just an incredibly enjoyable tool to use from day to day. Now let's look at some of these in a bit more detail. Right, you might be familiar with this advertising campaign from HSBC, which I quite like. It's looking at different objects and kind of some people see these elements in different ways. Object-oriented and so functional programming and object-oriented programming can be a little bit like this. You get some people who look at the functional programming language and actually find it a bit hard. They find it a bit, I don't know, somehow they just don't, it doesn't gel with them. And sometimes the object-oriented side of things also doesn't gel with various programmers. I have permission from Anders Halsberg to just show examples of F# and C# code. He just says, stop beating around the bush, just put it up there and show comparisons here. And a lot of you will be familiar with these kind of comparisons from, say, talks about dynamic languages. You get a lot of people moving towards languages like Python and Ruby to just make their programming quite a lot more succinct. And you know, there can be a feeling that sometimes in the object-oriented way of addressing some parts of the programming problem, that there can just be a lot of noise in the signal of these languages. That's not necessarily, noise itself is probably a bad thing, but F-sharp is an object-oriented language, and during the talk I'll try to explain how we see object-oriented programming fitting into the F-sharp methodology. So on the pleasure and pain kind of aspect, I guess I am one who tends to look more pleasurably on the functional programming way of doing things. So we take simple sort of object-oriented design patterns, one of the classic design patterns, the Gang of Four, from the design pattern books about the command pattern. So here we are, we're doing a simulator, and we're modeling a command for the simulator, which is simulating the movement of a rover on the surface of Mars. This was from a programming competition done last year. And we have two commands, a brake, which accelerates in backwards, -1, and turn left, which rotates so many degrees, and so on. And we look at the object-oriented encoding of this kind of model, and it goes on quite a long way. It actually goes on well below the floor somewhere down there. And you have your abstract class. You have an abstract class that captures the current rover, the Mars rover command, and you subclass that for the brake command, and so on. And of course, this is comparing with the purest object-oriented versus pure sort of the way of doing things in a functional programming language, and you might do this slightly differently in C-sharp with delegates and the like, but that's because C-sharp is partly a functional programming language. You might look at a simple thing such as a small embedded domain-specific language, which is you might use to model hardware circuits, for example, a very classic use of a functional programming language. You want your hardware engineers to be concentrating on doing analysis and verification of representations of hardware circuits. You probably don't want them concentrating on the object-oriented software engineering encoding of that programming problem. You want them just be able to take terms, data that represents the hardware circuits and use it fairly smoothly. This actually goes on probably to the bottom of the basement down here. We have the expression, the unary operators, the binary operators, the true expression, and so on, it goes on it goes. And that's fine at a certain level, but it does seem to be making slightly heavy weather of the problem. But it's not just about like competing for succinctness. There's this consistent theme in F-sharp programming that it's actually about programmers working more in their domain, okay? So that maybe the programmers are actually, they're not really programmers, they're actually financial engineers who are busy modeling financial contracts of the kind that have brought some disaster recently to the world. But they work for a bank which has these complex financial contracts on their books, and it's absolutely critical to the bank to be able to price these financial contracts and be able to run various simulations of these contracts under future projections, and they engage financial engineers to do this. And these financial engineers are not expert object-oriented programmers. They work in a domain of financial engineering, and these kind of people tend to be the kind of people who tend to be attracted to work to modeling problems in succinct ways that correspond directly with the domain they're working in, rather than slightly so much more structured and software engineering techniques. That's not to say F-sharp is definitely about structured software engineering as well. It's just we probably push that back a little bit in terms of the methodology. You'll spend more time in the problem exploration side of things, building your models or using various library components that you have to build a simulation or something. And then when it becomes necessary to make the transition into a software component, that's when you will usually do more of the software engineering work, the object-oriented design. So it's pushing that cost back a little bit. And as we all know, most software that is, say, written even by one person, most of those investigations, very few of those investigations actually become software components because, and whether something is worth making into a software component depends very much on the value of what it's doing. You can write the best code in the world. If it's not doing something really powerful and really useful, then then it's sort of wasted effort to put that engineering work in up front. So there's definitely trade-offs there, but the methodology for F# is much more in the start with the modeling side of things and to progress to components. Let's if we look at just some other examples, just so they're simple, you know, just see this stuff all over the place. If you just have simple functions, rotate a tuple or something, you got XYZ coming in, ZXY coming out, or you want to reduce a tuple by applying, say it's a vector, and you're applying a function to each element of a vector, three represented by a tuple, and you add them up. It's all very simple in a functional language. And okay, you can do this in C#. You know, I worked on C# generics. I was one of the co-designers and implementers of C# generics, and it's a great language, and I'm very proud of having made a contribution to that language. But on the other hand, it does sort of, if you're working in a data-oriented domain, where just taking data terms like tuples, lists, and so on is the routine part of your work and manipulating those and transforming those, then, I mean, it's a good language, but the functional languages also really excel in that kind of domain. Okay, there's another side to simplicity, which I'm sure everybody here will appreciate. It's a side which can sometimes be lost in a more academic context, and that is to do with .NET, of course, so how .NET makes things simple. So from a certain perspective, you know, .NET is a non-trivial bit of machinery, right? I mean, you've got garbage collectors and JIT compilers and all sorts of other things going on under the hood. But I think everybody here will have had the experience of using it, it makes the writing of software on top of the platform, the framework, very simple. And so this slide was taken from a talk given by C# developer in Australia, explaining F# to his audience. And the bit I like is, how on earth did he use a puppy to talk about a programming language? And what I like is that he's using puppies because it's got to do with, you look in his comments down the bottom of the slide, that's got to do with .NET. It's friendly. It means if you want to deploy F# components in a bank or something or some other institution, then you can do it because they're just .NET components. You can actually give them APIs that are just, you can't tell what language they're implemented in. And so, you know, this makes the language extremely friendly in comparison to, say, some of the other functional languages or some of the other programming languages you might know. So you know what .NET's like. You can, if whatever you need to do in software, there's almost certainly a .NET library to help you do it. There's, you know, you need to access Firebird database, you know, on Linux, Mono. There's a library to help you do it. It just goes, there's just so many high-value components out there. And this has sort of got to do with the economics of the argument now. This is just the network economic effect of working on a platform like .NET. And a big focus for us in F# is to really make sure you can write .NET components in this language. And .NET components that have a strongly typed interface that conform to the .NET framework design guidelines, if you need to. And this is really, really a major focus for us. Okay, so that's on the economic side of things. And I've already talked about the rest of the economic argument, which is that it's a fairly low-cost addition to the platform. You can see from the kind of succinctness that you're getting that it's also a high-value addition to the platform in certain programming domains. So the program of productivity, also just the sheer enjoyability aspect of it. There's this, to focus on the sort of the fun of using F#, it's been a consistent theme for me as I've shown F# to, yeah? I'll finish on the general side of things and then come back to this question. Yeah. It's been a consistent theme working with executives, giving them demonstrations of F# and the like, that you They take, for instance, they see the F-sharp way of solving a problem, and they come back to me and say, look, it's funny, I've seen this solution, and I know I could have done that in C-sharp. I know I could have used C-sharp in its functional kind of mode, but it would never have occurred to me to solve the problem that way. And there's something about it's by making a language that is oriented towards functional programming, it opens up a whole new ways of solving, of a regularly solving problems day to day in your work that aren't quite as accessible in the from the other languages on the platform. Okay, I'll do the overviews and then we'll come back to this question. The F-sharp can be seen as a merging of two traditions in programming language design. We have the tradition coming from the OCaml family of languages. Some people say there are no common ancestors between these two traditions. It's like men are from Mars, women are from Venus sort of thing. But that I think Algol 60 or something is a common ancestor. Though we have OCaml on one side and we have C-sharp and .NET on the other. We're taking the core functional language from this OCaml tradition of languages, and an object model from the C-sharp one, and then adding some particularly important things in to do with parallel and asynchronous programming as well. This combination actually applies to methodology as well. So this is a quote from Julien Lagel at this Eurostox company in Paris. He's a chief software architect of about a 50-person company, and he says, you notice if you look at the quote, F-sharp allows you to move smoothly in your program style. He starts with pure functional code. Now, that's interesting. Methodologically, you're using this functional programming to model a problem, to understand a problem, to create kind of an approximation of what's going on. And then you, in order to maintain the code in the long term or structure the code more, then you start applying object-oriented techniques. And then in order to make it efficient, you start applying some imperative programming where necessary. This is a standard F-sharp methodology. We're not total purists. It is an impure functional language. You can do imperative programming if you need to. And this is very much the methodology that we use. Now, that corresponds to starting with your idea, but finishing with realistic code. And that's what it's all about. Okay. So if you look at properties, the properties of various programming environments and languages have. I'm a big fan of kind of getting to give an analogy, there's an advertisement that I like that I've seen in a real estate agent in San Francisco, which has a triangle, and it's got 3 points of the triangle. It's on the wall. It says, good location, good house, and good price. And then it says down the bottom, pick any two. So sometimes programming languages can be like that. That, for instance, we have these great—these dynamic languages, which certainly fill a very important role in. Look how successful JavaScript is, for example. It's an incredibly important language. It's succinct, and the Pythons of the world are also very succinct. But at the same time, from my perspective, I don't want to give up on the static typing. If we're going to build large, if we're going to transition this stuff throughout the software development lifecycle, I really want static typing there to give my backbone to my software, to know that when other people come in and edit the code, they're not going to just make completely stupid mistakes where they which obviously break the typing properties of the language. I also want it to be efficient, and this has got a lot to do with static typing. I'm a fan of typing because it brings efficiency and because it gives your software a strength, a backbone. At the same time, we need our languages scalable, we need great libraries, we need also an explorative side to the development where necessary, and of course this huge theme of interoperability, which I've already mentioned. Okay, so to answer the actual technical question, yes, all the features that you use in F-sharp can be exposed in your APIs and can be used from C-sharp. That is, we also give guidelines about writing APIs using F-sharp, which conform, you should be conforming to the .NET guidelines, and that may mean not using certain F-sharp language constructs in APIs. That would be part of the methodology as you You could use certain things inside your software. As you publish your component, you would maybe use a restricted set of things on the outside. Okay, right, so let's take a look at some F# code. I've got Visual Studio. You've got a small screen here, so it depends. I've been pumping up the font size. Can the people see that at the back? It's okay. Luca Bolognese likes to point out that you can, if you right-click like a crazy man, then you can get Visual Studio to kind of look like just an editor. This is what I've done here. This font is really big on my screen. So let's do a bit of programming here. Okay, that's Hello World. So we've got F# Interactive down below. I'm not sure everybody can see that. Hopefully they can. We've printed out Hello World down below. We've done that by View, Other Windows, F# Interactive down here to bring that up. And this is just F# installed over Visual Studio 2008. And we can also do something else here. We can use the F# has a printf library, which is a strongly typed printing library, which sort of checks if you get your %Ds and the like in the right place in your printing. So let's create ourselves a form. Let's set a couple of properties here. Visible equals true, and topmost equals true. Create us a form, and we might set the text on the form. Say something that's very true. Okay, and we can add an event handler, so we can take the click event on the form, and we can add an event handler, which every time we click on the form, prints out something. Oops. Butterfingers today. FN click. You can add that event handler. And now when we come over, we click on the form. It's all registering a function that every time the event happens, the function gets executed. All very, very straightforward, just like registering a delegate with the click event. Okay, so most of this demo is going to be just doing some scripting with F# using a fair amount of imperative programming as we're going, with some functional elements like these event handlers being a sort of functional element for the programming. Many people use F# in a more pure functional programming kind of way, but when you're giving demos, especially visual demos, then you tend to have to do a fair bit of imperative programming with the .NET libraries to drive the APIs. Okay, so now we're going to do a few web requests if the internet connection is friendly to us. So we're going to just use the system.NET libraries. We're going to create a web request for the Yahoo homepage here, and we're going to get a response and a response stream. We're going to create a stream reader to read that to the end. Going to get the HTML for that web page, and you can see down below we've got some HTML being displayed. Right, so we can wrap that up into a function here to go and get a web page. So we've got a function which takes a URL here, which is a string, and fetches the contents of the web page as a string. Just to mention, we've got use here, which is just like using. So you might imagine this is effectively doing a try finally around this block of code, and it basically says make sure the response is closed at the end of the lexical scope, at the end of the function. So just making sure we dispose of our resources just like C# using. Now this is going to be important later on, where later on in the talk we're going to be doing an asynchronous version of this programming. And so this HTTP is actually going to be an asynchronous request for a web page, and in which case we also will use this word use, but it'll have a slightly different meaning, which means close the connection at the end of the asynchronous request, at the end of a series of connected asynchronous requests. So let's first of all do the synchronous version of web access. So now we can grab a few web pages, live.com, google.com. We'll also get the Sydney Morning Herald, which is a paper I read quite often. And the New York, we'll get an RSS feed from the New York Times here, just using a standard XML, fetch of an XML from their website. Right, so displaying data in the little interactive session down below is okay, but it's often better to display data in a form. So we'll pop this form away, and we'll work with this slightly bigger one, where we've set the size property on the form. We'll put a text box into the form and add that in, and we'll add in our standard click handler. Yeah, it's alive, that's good. And now we're going to have a couple of helper functions here to just print, set the print data, to show data in the form. Okay, and also one to add extra data to the form. So now we've got that, we can take some data, such as a value 1, and we can show it in the form. We take a tuple, 1, 2, we can show that in the form. We can also use this pipelining syntax to do the same. We take a tuple here, and we pipe it into the show function. This is a very simple thing, this pipelining function. You can define it just like this. Take an object, take a function, and apply the function to the object. So that's all it is. Okay. So that's pipelining. So now we're going to take the data 0 to 99, all the numbers, and we're going to show those in the form. And now we're going to, say, create some simple tables for each of the numbers from 0 to 99. We're going to create the number and its square. Okay, I times I. So we can see those. It's not formatted that nicely, but there is actually a way to format it slightly better, but unfortunately I didn't do that before the demonstration. But you can see the numbers and their squares being displayed. Or we might do something with floating point numbers to take a sine function over the range 0 to 99 with some scaling. Okay, so that's numerics and data. You can see that, like, creating data like this and working, you know, creating new data from existing data is smooth. And you can also see that the programmer can think more just in terms of data than in terms of objects. Of course, we implement all this with objects underneath, but you don't really think, you're not so aware of it at this level of the programming. You're just working with data and manipulating and transforming data. So let's work with some of the other data we've had, which is this XML from the New York Times. I'm just going to use the system.xml libraries for querying this. So we load up our XML into an XDoc, and XML document, and what we're going to do is select out all the titles here. And for each one that matches this XPath query, we're going to get the inner text of the node, and we're going to show those. Okay, so here's some latest headlines from the New York Times. So we see if Obama scored any headlines today. None for him. Crisis has been popular lately. None for them. Okay, let's see if we can find one. Okay. Launch. Okay, what do we have? Yeah. Okay, here we go. North Korea is doing something. Okay. All right. Okay, so now we're going to show, we're going to extract links from the web pages that we fetched, and we're going to build a little web crawler. So to extract the links, we're going to just use a regular expressions. It's a cheap shot way of extracting links, but it's effective enough. So we take the regular expression matches for, say, the Sydney Morning Herald links, and we can see there's a sequence of the links on the Sydney Morning Herald homepage. And now for each of those links, we extract them out, and actually there's a full set of links here. We only saw a prefix before. And then we're going to basically combine this HTTP function. We're also going to catch, if there's any exceptions, we're going to catch those. So given a URL, we're going to collect the links. We're going to take a string and give us a list of strings back, which are the links on that page. Okay, so we can collect the links for a particular home page, and we're just piping those into the show function once again. Okay, so now we can get links, we can build a web crawler. We're going to limit ourselves to 12 web pages. The crawler is a simple recursive function. A crawl here, which takes a set of places we visited already, and takes a URL, which is the one we're visiting. And we're just going to keep visiting new pages until we're done. So we check until the count is greater than the limit, or if the visitor set contains a particular URL, and then we continue on. So if it doesn't, then we do some display here. We're doing a synchronous web crawl, so we have to update the GUI as we display. We then call, collect the links. We add the URL to the visited set, and we just fold across all the URLs across the links, and we do a depth-first search of the entire web. Okay, so let's define that function, and we clear our text box, and we say start at news.google and see where we end up in 12 hops. And usually it's YouTube. We'll see. Yes, it is. YouTube. Good. Okay. They haven't changed their homepage enough. Or the header of the homepage must always get you to YouTube. Okay. So we've got a synchronous web crawl. We'll just display that data in a slightly different way. Grab ourselves a new form. Yeah. And we'll make a data grid view behind the scenes here and add that. And we'll make the crawl, the source, the data source. And we'll do 30 web pages this time. So it's a very similar thing, except in the middle, instead of displaying the form, we actually do this. We set the data source based on the visited set. All right, that's good. And let's crawl from here. And it's also showing us the number of links on each page as we go. Okay. There we go. So we'll just expand that out. And you can see the various sites we get to as we crawl. Where did we start? I think we started in news.google.com. Okay, great. Okay, so as I said, later on we'll be building an asynchronous web crawler, and but that will be later on in the second half of the talk. So, right. So, for the next demonstration, I'm going to do a quickly run through another use of the .NET libraries. This is using the managed DirectX libraries to do a 3D visualization. And it's quite a famous F-sharp demo, so I'm quickly going to show you this one because it's so enjoyable. This is a slightly different form. It's a form you have to draw yourself to make the animation a bit smoother. We're using a small library of around 300 lines of code. The managed DirectX libraries are quite low level, so you're creating the triangles yourselves, the triangle strips, and managing some of the update process. I actually quite like the library because I feel like I'm learning about DirectX as I'm using it, though probably you'd use WPF for this sort of work these days. So what we've done so far is that I've been adding elements to the display that each time the scene gets drawn, we add various elements to the 3D display, such as lights, cube axis. And these are defined in our little library of helper code. As I said, it's not a very long library. And we've added a view matrix, which sets the view parameters on each time around the scene. Now we're going to add a mouse tracker to the form. And the mouse tracker gives us a stream of events here. This is an event giving us pairs of mouse arguments as we drag the mouse across the form. And as the events get triggered, we're going to, depending on what the buttons were pressed, we're going to adjust various scene parameters, such as the your pitch role in the scene, as you can see here. Or we might adjust the zoom on the scene. So we're just modifying the view matrix each time around the loop. Now we're going to have a function to display. Because we're doing scripting, it's very common to mark things as mutable so you can play with them as part of your script. And we're going to draw a particular function over the display here. So there's a function of the x and y coordinates, and we have a mesh at the bottom. And for each element of the mesh, we evaluate that and create triangles for the surface. So we can also say set it to be another function, or set it to be a function of time as well as. Okay, and there's, we might adjust some other parameters, such as the range of interpretation of the display, or use a different function as the function that we're displaying. So we might also change the mesh underneath the display, or a coarser mesh, a 20 by 20 mesh. And now we're quickly going to do a simulation of movement on the surface. So we're given a function here which describes the surface here, which is the function of the x and y coordinates. We create ourselves a vector, which is from the origin to the x and the y coordinates, and the z coordinate, which is computed by the function. So once we can create points on the surface, we can also compute the normal to the surface. And with a little bit of work, we can create a little data structure to represent a ball. So there's a ball as a pair of a position here and a velocity. And we can set up some physical parameters. And we can have a function to move the ball. So given the input data structure, in the end, the move ball function computes a new position and a velocity down the bottom, a new position and a new velocity, and emits the new ball in its motion. And we have a function to draw the ball. And we have a function to draw the ball as a mesh. And we keep a list of active balls in the display here. See that? And we add functions to move the balls and to draw the balls into the simulation. Set ourselves a different surface initially, this ball. And now we're going to add balls into the display. So this one here. We can add another one here. And we might say start a train of balls. And this is going to be done by starting a little thread in the background. So this is we'll talk more about asynchronous and threaded programming later. But this is effectively the specification of a background task, background thread. You can think of it for this purpose. And this task is going to start up in the background and sort of toss balls into the display and after it tosses each ball in, it's going to toss them in at the same position. It's going to do a sleep for 100 milliseconds and then continue on. So now we start that up and we get a little train of balls coming into the display on the right. And we can do that again, again. There's no collision in the simulation, as you can see. That would be a lot of fun. So now we can say move the surface, and you say it goes upside down, chaotic straight away. Maybe we move this a little bit faster. Faster still. Here we go. And maybe we change back to the ripple, and you can see this. And they all actually sort of end up in the middle, and then they get thrown out. We've made it that we tie the balls to the surfaces if they've got little magnets on them or something. So you can see you see the computations that are going on. Okay, great. Maybe we want that over a finer granularity of mesh simulation. Okay, so I hope that gives a feeling for using the .NET libraries and for using F# in its more explorative kind of mode. And for also the fact that you quite quickly feel like you're in a domain. We're in the domain of simulation, for example, of 3D simulation, and maybe working less on the structure of the code. Of course, it's crucially important to be able to take that code and transform it into good software components over time. So if we look at the design of F#, you see it's got this functional programming language core, and it's got this object-oriented programming model, which is totally part of the core language. You can use objects all the time in your programming. And we also have a strong emphasis on functional data, lists and tuples and sets and maps and things, which are less concentration on mutating the data, more concentration on transforming it. On top of this functional core, we do add some features like units of measure, which actually let you go through and annotate if you're doing simulations, for example, with physical, you can annotate it with physical units such as kilometers, meters per second, and the like. This is only used if you're dealing with floating point numbers an awful lot. Like we might have used it in that simulation code, but I wasn't doing that for in that code, but we might have used it. So you can think of this as a type system for floating point numbers is a great way to think of it. On top of this core, we have made the decision to make F-sharp an impure functional language, so you can do I/O, you can do side effects, you can do printing, you can work you can create a mesh, you know, halfway through display, you suddenly create a mesh by reading a file or something. You can do that in F-sharp, and that places it much more like Scheme or the OCaml family of languages, and also makes it very familiar to C-sharp programmers who also use mutation in all over the place. On top of this, we add two features. One is a feature especially for parallel programming, really focusing on doing parallel and reactive and concurrent programming. The general name of the feature is a slightly technical term called computation expressions, but you can just think of this as being for parallel programming. And the other side is we add a metaprogramming story for things like link, for expression trees, and the like. And you can kind of see these as slightly off to the side, that most of your program is written in the stuff on the right-hand side, and then these things are used for more special kinds of purposes, such as concurrent programming. Okay, you've seen some of the language already. You just say we have things like XML doc comments with your triple slashes here. Just the usual things you'd expect from language, arithmetic, and Booleans, and the like. This is just a slide which you just end up writing let quite a lot in F sharp. You just write let. If you're binding data, there you just use let. If you're binding a static function, you just use let, and then to list the parameters. You might be binding a local value, you just use let for the value, and so on. And you can also say have a local function. So the language doesn't have many corners. It has these orthogonal and unified constructs that you'd hope from any programming language. Yeah?
How do you know when the function ends?
It's based on white space indentation. So F-sharp uses white space indentation all the way through. It just makes the language very succinct and clear, and gives a nice uniformity to the code that's written. C-sharp also does that nicely by having editors which format the code in very regular kinds of ways. So it's a slightly different way of ensuring that. Just to say, the language is type inferred. You've seen all the way through I was using the hover over a value to look at what its type is. Visual Studio knows the types of all of your code. You get red squigglies when you make mistakes. Strong typing is not just about giving your code backbone, but it's also just about making sure that the editor can give you lots and lots of information to help you with your programming, your IntelliSense, and all the usual things that you expect from a typed programming language. And so that means we get the succinctness of a scripting language through type inference, but we get the safety of C-sharp in that everything is strongly typed. Right. To talk about functions. Functions is a building block for an awful lot of F-sharp programming. It's an anonymous function value, a lambda expression. This is to declare a function. As soon as you declare a function, you can use it in a first-class way. You can have a pair of function values if that's what you need. And that's how you write a function type. We say f is a value which takes integers to integers. Okay, so lots of concepts that you get in the .NET libraries, all the different delegates more or less drop out to be functions. So you'll see functions being used for predicates, for sending messages, for starting threads, for a comparison function, for hashing values, equality, and so on. Okay, so there's just some sample functional code, declaring functions, creating a pair, taking the first of tuples, creating some data. And there's a very general mechanism called pattern matching, which lets you can see that as being a simultaneous decision, a switch, and decomposition of the input. So you take an input, you decide where to go, and you decompose it on the various cases of the pattern matching. So this is taking the data and saying, looking at the data, okay, the data is a tuple. Okay, if the left hand right contains something, and we've got some numbers, and the right hand side contains some numbers, then do something over on the right. And otherwise, the various other cases of the data that you're working with. And you've seen the kind of functional programming constructs you use all day long, your lists and your sequences. Sequences are our name for IEnumerable. Arrays and lazy values to delay computation. Sets for building sets of data. and so on through the various functional programming constructs. And you've seen they're creating lists and creating lazy streams of data. So we have ranges and lists via a query, or an array via a query, or an IEnumerable via a query. Just to say, data is immutable by default, that if you define a value like pi, you can't go and change it by default unless you explicitly label things as mutable. That if you define a data structure such as this one, the defaults are all towards immutable data. That means if you want to create Bob Jr. from Bob, you have to take Bob, and this is a copy and update. Okay? And you do not go and mutate Bob's birthday. Okay, immutability is a great thing when it's the sensible. I mean, there are definitely times when immutability is absolutely not the right design choice for critical data structures. We have plenty of uses of F# where the critical data structure is a massive array, and you have to write into it, and you're using it in a linear way, and that's fine. Of course, you have to do that for many programming tasks, but the aim is to make as much of your code use immutable data as is reasonable. In some sense, it's up to you as a programmer, but the whole tendency of the language as you use it is to make more and more of your data immutable. Immutable objects just have lovely logical properties. You can rely on them. You get one back from an API, you know nobody else is going to futz with it. You can transfer them between threads, which is critical, that you can hand off a complex immutable data structure like a map or a set and give it to another thread. And you're obviously just transferring the object pointer across, but the other thread, there's no locks, no concurrency problems or anything. You can send messages containing rich information very efficiently. And just to say, there are lots of interesting optimization techniques with immutable data and interesting data structures that you can build, which are surprisingly efficient. As you're building data, you can do things, a very rich language of generated lists, a lot like iterators in C#. So for instance, if we want to get all the files in a directory, we can create a list which gets all the files and yields each file. And then the yield bang is about yielding many files. So we recursively yield all the files in the subdirectories. And so then we can take all the files in a particular directory and return them. Just to say, we might also want to do that in an on-demand way. And here we're creating a sequence, an on-demand sequence, which means that it won't immediately go and find all those files. It'll give you a handle to an iterator which will yield the files when necessary. And that, of course, as you know from any link programming that you've been doing, is a great way of sort of making a query and then doing a subsequent transformation on that query. So we might take all the files in the Windows directory and take the prefix of that, the first 100, and then show those. Okay. Just to say, F# is not weakly typed, it's strongly typed. It looks weakly typed, but it's all type inferred. And this means it's typed, yet it has a strong dynamic programming side to it. You can do reflection, you can do a bunch of interesting dynamic techniques, but it's efficient. Most of the code you write, it just runs at the regular speed of C#, the same as C#. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about object-oriented programming. So this is the syntax. So we have a type, an object type of some kind, and then it has some internal values, internal functions, and perhaps some mutable state. And then it publishes some members, some properties, and some methods. Okay, and these are the arguments to the primary constructor for the type. So typically your object types will have a primary constructor. And this is, say, the syntax for constructing an object. And you can define interfaces and abstract members and things like that. We have effectively the C# object model as well, in a slightly different and more syntax more suited to functional programming. So let's create a functional object. So this vector is going to take two inputs, a dx and a dy. And so these are the arguments to the constructor. And then so that's the inputs to the object construction. And then we publish a whole bunch of exported properties. So these are implicitly the fields to the object in this case. We publish those as properties dx and dy. Objects tend to be very asymmetric. You put in a little bit of data, you get a lot of data out the side, a lot of properties. Or you put in a lot of data and you get only a few properties. That's one of the great advantages of object-oriented programming. you can model those kind of entities. And so you can see we use dx dy through. We have a property here, which is this is computed each time. The v is the this pointer, the name for the this pointer. You can use any name you want there. And this is at the bottom here, we have a method to scale and produce a new vector. Okay, you see it's all type inferred. You can hover your mouse over this code and you'll get all the types in Visual Studio. Objects can also have internal or pre-computed values. Okay, so this will also become a field of the object. So we take the inputs and we pre-compute the norm 2, in this case something, and then we publish that as one of the properties and maybe use that in a couple of the properties down below. Okay. So this kind of approach makes a lovely transition from you've done your prototyping with your functional code. So this is an example taken from Luke Hoban's blog. He's a program manager for F#. And so assume you've just been scripting away. You've created a functional program for Huffman encoding. And the inputs to Huffman encoding are a frequency table. So you take those as the input to your Huffman encoding object. Okay, so we're defining a new class of objects. You put your functional programming code, you indent it 4 spaces, you highlight, press tab in Visual Studio, and then you publish the API to that algorithm. And the API is simply encode and decode. All of this here is full of let bindings. That all becomes internal. And your members are your API to your object. And now, because this is just using sequences here, which are enumerables, then this is exactly an API that any C#... you can use this directly from C#, and it's just exactly the expected API from C#. Okay, immutable inputs, internal tables, and we publish access to the algorithm. Okay, just to say, you can use internal state if you want. You can label these let bindings as mutable, and these become mutable fields of the object. You can change them. And down here, you can see it's actually updating that data. So it is an impure language, and you can do mutation if necessary. Publish internal state and mutate the internal state. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about an application of F# inside Microsoft. We do talk a bit about this externally because there are external people in the audience. Speaking in some general terms, I've changed some numbers to just show N rather than sort of exact figures. So we all know about AdCenter, we all know about that major companies make a lot of money by displaying ads on the internet in response to search queries, and Microsoft obviously in this business as well. There's a huge infrastructure necessary to deliver ads effectively in situations such as this. But it's not only about the delivery, it's also about the algorithms you use to choose which ads to display. If you're putting an ad in the sports section of the newspaper, is it a good idea to put an ad for the opera in the sports section? Probably not, okay? Probably not. And that's a key thing. The analysis is a probabilistic analysis about your expectations of the users, what you know about the context, what you know about the ads. Now, if someone was willing to pay enough to have an ad for the opera in the sports section, then, hey, okay, we do it. Okay, that's no problem if you really want it. Maybe it's really important to them. So it also depends on the price of the ads. And we know the prices for these ads, we know the prices through the auctioning system that goes on in, this is the AdCenter auctioning site. Okay, so it's a very interesting mathematical problem. And if you can do better at choosing the right ads to display, building a predictive engine for displaying the right ads, it actually makes a really substantial difference to the base revenue of an operation like AdCenter or in Google. So they ran a competition internally inside Microsoft. They had a very large amount of impressions of ads. So each of these impressions, we know whether the people clicked on the ad or not. They also gave the teams, so there were about 7 teams who entered around Microsoft, and they gave them 2 weeks running full bore on a 64-bit machine to train up their model against this data. And they gave them 4 weeks to develop the algorithms and then 2 weeks to train their models. And they had certain speed requirements about them being able to do so many updates per second and so many microsecond, milliseconds per for each new bit of information. So the people using F# were machine learning experts. They were not, I mean, they're good programmers, but their job in Microsoft Research is as machine learning experts. They use a probabilistic modeling technique called factor graphs. There's actually, they've separately published a very, very lovely use of factor graphs for doing, for modeling skills in chess games. You can go and look at their analysis of the entire history of chess games in from a corpus of chess games and see their analysis about who was better than who. And it's sort of a similar technique. So their model had a, and it's all in F# code, it's about 4,000 lines of F# code. It's very, very, very sweet code. So their model has 100 million probabilistic variables. And in theory, every time you get a new bit of information in this model, you have to update all 100 million variables, okay? Now, that's not going to scale. So the key scientific advance is to do what they call approximate inference with these things. And they implement these approximate inference algorithms where they only update a few variables. They implement those using F#. And they won the competition. And their code is being deployed across to AdCenter. And in fact, some of the ads that you get today from live.com and the others are being run through models which are trained on one of the background servers. Those models are trained running that F# code. And that's been very successful deployment, a very, very valuable component. Just to say, F# served their role really well. You know, the type inference just means you do less typing and more thinking about your problem. The code was interesting to watch over their shoulder as they were doing this. They would quite quickly, like, take part of the problem and kind of refactor it or parameterize it by another function, and that was the language suited them very well there. They did a fair bit of scripting. The performance was absolutely critical, as you can see with the numbers that were involved. They created very large data structures, maxing out a 16 gigabyte machine with floating point numbers, just enormous arrays of floating point numbers representing these variables. And so they were really living in their problem domain, not in the software engineering all the time, although it is good code, good enough. And they also used the symbolic computation side of things as part of their algorithmic side. That was crucial to this approximate inference that they were doing. And .NET integration was essential as well, Excel and SQL Server. Okay, so F# is very much about smooth transitions, about getting ideas from a researcher's brain into realistic and efficient code against real data, such as the data sets we were just talking about, and then taking those realistic and efficient code into a component, and then from a component to actually deployment in a bank or in AdCenter or in any enterprise kind of situation where they're running .NET code. Okay. Right. So we don't normally take a break, do we? Just run through. Okay. So any questions while I just take a glass of water? Okay, let's continue on. So in the last part of the talk, we're going to look at a little bit of async and parallel programming with F#. This is more of the advanced end of F# programming. But it's also a lot of fun. So it's always fun to show this because this stuff can be very hard to do in other programming languages. I mean, it's tricky as well. It can have its tricky side in any language. I'll talk about that a bit in a moment. But we're going to be looking at this primitive called async. This slide deck is missing a slide. I want to talk a bit about methodology first. We really do still expect people to be good architects here. If you're going to do asynchronous programming or you're going to do parallel programming or concurrent programming, you need to have your architecture right, okay? But F#, the role that F# serves is about having good architecture and translating that into good code, okay? Again, it's about minimizing that transition cost, allowing your architect really get there and program out the idea and then transition that from that point. So async is one primitive we use to build good asynchronous, parallel, and reactive architectures. It's not an architecture in itself. It's just a primitive. Okay. If you want to think about an asynchronous computation, think of it a bit like a closure, a bit like a function, a bit like a delegate. You can give it to someone to run. It's like giving your builder a job. Your builder is working on your house, and you ask your builder to do something, but the builder says, all right, I can do it. You know, when you run this thing, I can do it, but I might have to talk to someone else about it. I might have to, I might have to subcontract it out to several people. You know, first I have to get someone to do this, and then this, and then this, and all right, it'll take me a while. You just get on with your life. I'll get back to you when I'm done. Okay, I'll call a continuation when I'm done. Okay, so it's very much about, that's what you should think of when you have an async value. You can run it, and sooner or later you'll get the result. Sooner or later it will call you back. Okay, so just to say, you'll see code like this. So you'll have async, and then you'll see things in the middle which look a lot like F# code, except that we've marked up some particular points with this bang and this read async here. And by async, we mean a non-blocking action. And what this means is when you run this code, while that read is going on, or while that web request is going on, we're not going to jam up your operating system threads. Okay? So we all know that operating system threads are kind of expensive. The .NET threads map down to operating system threads. And you can't have 20,000 of them on your machine. Okay? You might want to have 20,000 web requests, because you're building a web crawler, but you can't have 20,000 threads, typically, running on your machine. So you have to unblock the thread. You have to wait for the result to come back. And that's what all this programming is about. So you have some asynchronous, non-blocking action. And you should think of the rest of the code as just being a callback, okay? Just like in a GUI, just like that clicking, okay? It's just something that when that event comes back, we're going to call the callback, okay? So it's a way of this. You look at this as a way of letting you write callback-rich code, which involves sort of sequencing through that, without totally having a big mess of callbacks and delegates and everything else. Okay, so let's look at some examples. Okay, this is just a slide actually. I meant translating good architecture into good code. Okay, so let's have a look at this. Okay, so I'm referencing a component called the F# Power Pack, which is an open source project, and that has the definition of these asynchronous web requests, which aren't in the core F# library, though they're very simple to define. I'm just finding a couple of helper functions. Here's one which calls this async run synchronously. And that just runs an async. It's like giving the job to your builder, but really waiting around until it finishes, okay? Because we actually want to show it. And we're also using a little function to help us show things on the screen here. Right, so we can create a little asynchronous task down the bottom, return 1 plus 1. I mean, you wouldn't run that on a separate thread, but just for example, we can run that, and we can show the result, and we have the result 2 here. I should make a bigger font here, so my apologies for that. I'll do that for the next talk. Okay, just to say these little asynchronous tasks here, they can also do side effects, like they can print something if necessary. So if we take that task and we run it, then we get the value 7, but you also notice we've got hello world down the bottom. So you can think of these for the moment as like little specifications of threads, tasks. And if you're into the task parallel library, you can also use these as a way of specifying, you know, what should a task do and what's the task. It's like structured programming with tasks. Okay, now, given P and P2, we can now put these two things in parallel. Okay, so we can take P here and P2, this, and we can. So we've got the parallel composition of these two tasks. So they're going to be run together, and we're going to wait for the result. And we can then run that, and we can show the result. Okay, something went wrong there. Okay, not sure what happened. Maybe But we get the results 2 and 7, our tiny font coming out. But you can see that those may, so basically we've created two tasks. We've put them both in the task scheduler, which is the .NET thread pool in this case. And we've run those two tasks. That queue is being served by various CPU threads. We can create lots and lots of tasks. We can keep all the CPU threads busy, depending on how many processes we have on the machine. And so we can do CPU intensive parallelism if we need to. So that's good. So we might, for instance, create two more tasks and show those. Or we might create 100 tasks and run those. And if we pipe that into show here, then we've just created 100 different jobs, run them all in parallel, or a bit of parallelism, depending how many CPU threads we have, collect up the results and show them. So that's fork join parallelism made easy. So let's do a similar thing, because what's interesting now is not just to do computations, like adding numbers, but to actually do web requests in the middle of these tasks. Like we might, in the middle of an asynchronous computation, we want to go away, we want to do a web request. And then we wait for the result to come back, and it comes back. And then, depending on what the first website said, we go to a different website and do another web request. So first, this is the synchronous version of the web request code that we used at the start of the talk. And now this will be the asynchronous version. And something that's very beautiful here is that you basically take the synchronous version of the code, and you simply put async around it, and you mark up the asynchronous points with these bang constructs. You take the same language constructs and realize we want to get the response asynchronously. So you use async get response on the right, and it's all type checked to make sure you get the thing right. And we get an asynchronous version of the web request. So now we can run an asynchronous thing, and this is just like when you do a run and of an asynchronous, it's just like doing the synchronous version, but now we can do a parallel, we can get two websites in parallel, and then they, sooner or later they both come back. When they're both back, we display the results. Okay. Or we could do things in sequence. So we could take the first page here, and we're not quite using it in this example, but you could make this, what you do, which page you get for the second page depend on what came back in the first one. So you're kind of creating a workflow of asynchronous work. And we can do that for these two websites, and then wait for them both to come back. There we go. So this was taking the sum of the lengths of these two home pages for live.com and Google. Okay, so that's good. So now we can take maybe take the average length of three web pages. So this is 13,000 is the average length. So we do a parallel composition, wait for them all to come back, do a map. To get the current length and take the average and show it. Maybe we take a slightly larger set of URLs, and this is a similar thing. So we can take the results and show the lengths of these results here. Okay, so that's all good. Okay. Quickly want to show a related slide here. So basically, for those of you who have used the corresponding .NET APIs, we're talking about taking these APIs like begin read and begin write and making programming with these things sort of compositional. So we have begin read, end read, rest of task, and you can do compositional thread hopping, compositional programming with these asynchronous APIs. They are quite hard to use otherwise, these APIs. Okay. So just to say, this code which I'm showing here, which you obviously can't see because it's too small, is the starter C# sample or MSDN sample for asynchronous programming with the .NET libraries. It's quite a lot of code. You have these callbacks, and we're basically processing images in parallel. But you have to explicitly count up the images as they get processed. You have to use locks in order to implement the fork join. And it's not very compositional in this programming, and the code is also actually full of bugs as well. The code, it's full of bugs because if something goes wrong in the middle of one of these asynchronous workflows, then it's not recovering from that problem. And to augment this code with the recovery necessary to close the file handles on the backout paths and the like, really is a very large amount of code. So just to say, that's the equivalent F-sharp code here, which is just this code. It's the same performance, but it's declaratively showing the workflow of the asynchronous computation. And it's very simple. We just go through, we open the file. There's a synchronous action. You can tell it's synchronous because it doesn't have a bang on this side. Then we do an asynchronous read of the file. And you can tell it's asynchronous because of the bang on the left. We then do some synchronous transformations of the image here, and a synchronous write of the file. No, an asynchronous write of the file here. And then we take the parallel composition of those and we process our images. And the great thing here is that you're using the parallelism in your disk, because you can do parallel reads and parallel writes on any hard disk. And the operating system is looking after that. And you're doing parallel computation in the CPU as you transform the images, as the reads come back and you process there. So the algorithm is stable under parallelism in the disk or parallelism in the CPU. And you're not really aware which one you're exploiting the most. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to finish up with an asynchronous web crawl. So I talked about making good architectures out of the async building blocks. What I'm going to do here is use an example of a design pattern built out of async, primitives. And this is a background crawler component. So this can crawl anything. The background component, this background parallel crawl, is just a generic .NET component implemented using about 50 lines, 100 lines of F-sharp code that could do any sort of asynchronous crawl. Okay, that is the action at each step of the graph that we're exploring. Can go get web pages, can do other asynchronous reads and writes. We're going to use it to crawl the actual web, and we're going to do that by making sure that at each step of the way, this visitor of this virtual graph out there called the web is going to get the links asynchronously, and that will tell it how to get to the next step of the crawl. So we have our crawler, and now this is not just a matter of like doing an infinite crawl and then waiting for it to come back. This is actually going to trigger an event. It's a good component. It's a good .NET component because it's got an event on it. So we can get some update on what's happening along the way. So every time the crawl set has changed, we're going to get notified with an event back on the GUI thread about what is going on with the crawler. So we created our crawler, and now we create a form to display the data, just like we did before. Create a data grid here, and we add that control. Add some sample data to populate the form, and display the URL and the links. And every time the crawl set changes, just like in the click event, we're going to add something which updates the data source with information about how far we've got. And now what I want you to notice is as we do the crawl, when we start the crawl, we're going to start from the Google, news.google.com. We're going to have many requests outstanding simultaneously. Okay, so if we start it here, so we have the first request available. Now we got the first page and found all the links on it, and we did lots and lots of requests. And this background crawler component is exploring the web, and at each time it gets a response, it tells the GUI thread what's going on. So we've abstracted away the complexity of doing a crawl, and now we're instantiating it with a particular kind of crawl that we want to do. So similarly, we can say crawl other home pages. Here's Google. And we're showing the number of links on each of these pages as we go. Or the live.com. And here's Yahoo. Yeah, something goes wrong with Yahoo. So I'll finish up now. To say, if you want to learn F#, as I say, a lot of people say it helps them become a better C# programmer as well. I encourage you to just get it and learn it. You could just use F# Interactive like I've been doing here. These samples are actually not included in the distribution. They're the Codeplex F# samples now. We've put them all up on Codeplex. Anyway, look around and just search for F# samples, you'll find them. You can also just use Godot definition and look at our library code. We include the source with the F# release. And you can also just run Reflector. Some people like doing that, seeing what it looks like, the compiled form of your F# code, seeing what it looks like in C#. And there's a community site, this HubFS is a great one. And there are also some books. And you can also just go and learn a different functional language. If you're a functional programmer, go and learn an object-oriented language. You can learn ML or you can learn Haskell and then come to F#. And this is also very good training. So in terms of books, we have Foundations of F#, which is a good introduction probably for enterprise programmers. Expert F#, which goes into a lot more depth about things like the asynchronous programming. F# for scientists, if you have a sort of a background interest in the sort of scientific kind of applications. There's also this new book, Functional Programming with Examples in F# and C#. That's mainly available as a web book at the moment. Some chapters are available. So if one of these books is sort of being co-developed with the readers, as you get a lot of feedback from the readers as he goes. And F#.net is the website. So we've released a CTP in September 2008, and it will be a supported language in Visual Studio 2010. In 2010, we're concentrating on the core strengths of the language. For instance, we don't see F#. F# is not a replacement for C#, right? We've outlined clearly the kind of tasks that we expect it to be used for. And in particular, we won't have designers that generate F# code in the Visual Studio 2010. It is not what we call a presentational programming language. It's not for doing the design, the visual designer kind of work. You would use a mixed language F#, C# project for that kind of thing, or C# Visual Basic. And next one will be in Visual Studio 2010 Beta 1. We will continue to support a 2008 release of F#. Well, actually, it's not officially supported, but it's this sort of CTP level release of 2008, tools for 2008. And gladly take questions, and thank you very much for having me here in Copenhagen.